You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM, 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. Our topic will be the prevention of domestic violence, sometimes called relationship abuse, including the use of the Domestic Violence Prevention Act. If you have questions for my guests, our telephone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the local dialing area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Tonight I have two very knowledgeable guests with me here in the studio. Formerly the family law facilitator for the San Mateo County Superior Court, Lauren Zorfis practices family law at ADZ Law in San Mateo. Melissa Gibbs is the manager of legal services at CORA, that's Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse, also in San Mateo. Let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'd like to start by inviting anyone who has an interest in issues surrounding relationship abuse, whether between married persons or those dating one another, or even between parent and child. This really should be all of us. Anyone who has an interest in these issues, please call in. Again, the phone number for us in the studio, phone number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. And again, with that, Lauren, Melissa, let me welcome each of you. And I'd like to start with this. In a moment, we'll get to defining domestic violence. We'll get to nuts and bolts and where people can go. But I'd really like to give each of you a chance to tell me a little bit about your background. What really is it that brings you here tonight?
Well, I'll start. This is Lauren. I think the first thing that brought me here tonight was that you asked me to be here. So I thank you for that invitation. But the other reason that I'm here tonight is I'm very passionate about issues around relationship abuse and domestic violence. And it was the foundation of the firm that I'm with, ADZ Law. I have two partners, and we all come from different areas within the domestic violence community. My partner is the former Melissa Gibbs. She was the manager of legal services at CORA, and my other partner was the supervising attorney at Bay Area Legal Aid, and she ran the restraining order clinic, and we've worked on domestic violence issues for years, and I've always worked in family law, and the Domestic Violence Prevention Act, which we're going to be talking about tonight, is actually part of the family code and is very embedded in what I do. So I welcome the opportunity to talk about domestic violence issues, how it affects our community, and how it's woven into the fabric of family law.
And of course, we're not there yet, but momentarily when we do talk about this, the Domestic Violence Prevention Act is but one tool dealing with domestic violence, and of course there's other tools available we'll talk about as well.
That's correct.
Melissa, welcome. I'd ask you the same thing, if you could tell us a little bit about what brings you here.
Sure. I got my interest in domestic violence during law school when I was working with the district attorney's office in the family violence unit, and got to meet a lot of victims and survivors of domestic violence through my time with that office, and realized the many different ways in which survivors need support. It's not just one legal system that they have to navigate. It's many legal systems that they have to navigate. And being a Bay Area native, I was very fortunate that I got the opportunity to join CORA, which is the domestic violence agency in San Mateo County. We have a 24-hour hotline, emergency shelter, transitional shelter, legal services, and mental health services for survivors of intimate partner abuse and their children.
And again, for those that are not familiar with it, CORA is actually the Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse?
Correct.
This is the sole reason you're here?
Yes.
And I guess my first question, I know we have a caller on cue that may be coming in soon, but before we get there, can one of you tell me a little bit about just what is domestic violence?
Well, there are actually many different definitions of domestic violence. CORA subscribes to the social definition of domestic violence, which really is about power and control. It's one individual in an intimate relationship using threats of violence, coercion, to really maintain a position of power over their intimate partner. And this can come in many different forms. It might be physical abuse. It might be emotional abuse or verbal abuse, psychological abuse, spiritual abuse, financial abuse. There's many different forms of abuse that individuals who exert power and control can use to coerce and really maintain control over their partner.
Would it be fair to say when we're talking about domestic violence within the context of what CORA does, what the courts do, it's really not so much limited to what we might consider physical violence, but myriad forms of abuse?
Well, yes. As Melissa was stating, there is a power and control dynamic in domestic violence. We sometimes refer to it as coercive control. And you find that sort of mirrored in the definition that's contained in the Family Code under the Domestic Violence Prevention Act, which we call the DVPA. And the DVPA defines domestic violence very specifically. First, it defines the relationship has to be one where there was some kind of intimacy, so a former dating partner, a former spouse, a close blood relative. Those all qualify as the domestic part of the relationship. And when we look to the violence part of the definition, the code actually, I just happen to have it in front of me. It talks about what abuse really is. And I don't like to read on the air, but I'll just, because I want to get it exactly right. Abuse is intentionally or recklessly causing or to attempt to cause bodily injury, sexual assault, or to place a person in reasonable apprehension of imminent serious bodily injury to that person or another. So you don't actually have to have an act. You have to be afraid that somebody might harm you or another. There's also a very sort of broad definition of abuse that talks about harassment. And I won't read this, but it does take up about a paragraph in the code book that talks about what does it mean to have harassing behavior? What does it mean for annoying telephone calls, disturbing the peace of another person, which is really been developed in case law, and I'll kind of go off on a tangent here for a moment, if I may, that the laws that apply to the cases that go through our court come from two places. It comes from our code books, the statutes, and then that gets developed in case law. And what we see a lot of times with domestic violence is this is an emerging area of law, meaning it's constantly being redefined. And the breadth and the scope of what the court is going to look at and qualify as domestic violence is really, I think, being fleshed out in the idea of this idea of disturbing the peace of another party, posting things on an internet website about somebody, hacking into somebody's emails. There's all been cases around these issues, and they're defined as domestic violence under the law.
Now, thus far, we've been talking about family law. There are other expressions of domestic violence that we will reach in a moment. But before we do, Carlos in Oakland, welcome. You're on your legal rights.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question, and thank you for reading all these definitions as well, because it really helps clarify the issue in my mind. My daughter is about to turn 14, and for many years, her mother has engaged in a pattern of behavior that's been alienating her affections, not necessarily directly from me, although that has begun lately as well, but from the child's beloved stepmother, who she took to calling Mama from when she was 4 years old, incensed the bio mom so much that she just began this sorry. It really hurts how it's stealing Audrey's heart away. But she has encouraged her to lie to me and keep secrets about what goes on when she's at the mother's house. She has chosen a therapist for Audrey who is just not suitable and is, you know, in the mother's pocket. And then when it comes to court, I guess to try to bring it back to the show and the show's topic, she has an attorney who's like family law and criminal defense and knows how to just get her out of any trouble that she causes herself. And meanwhile, you know, I can't afford a lawyer, and I've just been trying to defend myself and come to a point where there's a possibility that the mother will not win this time. And I've been looking for options in reunification and how to get the court to kind of help me and my wife, who Audrey and I both love, reunified. And I was hoping the panel can shed some light on it. And thank you for listening. Sorry it's taken so long.
Carlos, thank you for joining us. And I would ask either or both of you, what protections are there for someone like Carlos, who is self-represented in the light of an attorney that perhaps takes advantage of the form in a way that someone who represents themselves can't?
Well, it's a real issue in our family courts that a lot of litigants going through family law can't afford attorneys. And there have been some pilot projects in the state that are trying to look at the efficacy of having representation appointed for exactly these types of situations, custody and visitation. It's a real issue for the court. It's a real issue for the state. Having people that are going through this process that, you know, the court is a very formal forum, but this is your family that we're talking about. And there are right now no mechanisms in place to have court-appointed counsel for those that are going through family law. And there are self-help centers. The office that I used to work for at the court, the family law facilitator, which in most counties has merged with the self-help center, can offer information. They can't give advice, but they can give information. There is – family law has really – taken on and pioneered the idea of what we call limited scope services, where you can have an attorney represent you for a piece of your legal case. It can be representation at a hearing only. It can be representation for counsel and advice only. So you're not paying the full cost of full representation. But I think, Carlos, with the issues that you are facing, it's just a very, very difficult situation. There are mechanisms in place where the court can order what's called a custody evaluation, where a professional, usually a psychologist, is going to come in and do a full evaluation of what's going on within the custody context of your case. And a real savvy custody evaluator can really kind of get to the bottom of what's going on and make appropriate recommendations to make sure that the child's best interests are really being looked after.
I would just like to add that most counties have some type of legal services that are available, whether it's the family law facilitator's office that Lauren mentioned. Every county in the state of California has either a self-help center or a family law facilitator's office that pro per litigants can access to understand what the legal processes are and obtain assistance in filling out the requests for orders, the motions that are necessary to bring these cases before the court. Additionally, most counties have nonprofit legal services where you can call and speak to an attorney to get some brief information or advice, and really just encourage you, Carlos, to reach out to the services that are available in your county.
Carlos, one of the things that's been prevalent in recent years, the courts have been downsized significantly in recent years. But the budget is starting to come back. The courts have been strangled for fees. Their budgets have been cut by more than a third for about the last 7 years. And this year, for the first time, beginning to see light at the end of the tunnel, more money is coming in. And it's projects such as these that are given a very high priority. When lobbying the legislature every single year for the last 6 or 7 years, I and a host of people like me have been talking to legislators about restoring the budgets to the court. And the first thing we talk about are families that can't get restraining orders, people that can't get someone to evaluate their cases. We have children who are growing more than a 2, 3, 4 years into a process where nobody's listening to what's best for them because they don't have anybody to do that kind of an evaluation. I don't practice family law, but I do see a lot of what's going on, and I do see it getting better, and it's starting now. So we're happy if you have a follow-up question, but I can't encourage you enough to hang in there. Things are looking better.
Well, thank you. Thanks for all you've said. Yeah, we've tried the self-help centers, and it's very difficult to get any kind of help. Just kind of a technical hot tip about dealing with clerks and clerks in the courtrooms. Like, they will lose your paperwork or slow walk it or something just because, I don't know, they don't like the tone of your voice. I don't want to seem glib, but every time that there's a hearing, there's two versions of the findings in order, mine and the other side's. And more often than not, something happens to mine that it then gets rejected because they've already approved the other one. And is that just going to keep happening because, you know, lawyers get feedback into the commissioner's annual review and pro per people don't?
Carlos,
I guess this might follow up. It's just a strange climate.
I don't want to take anything away from my guest, and I'll turn the question to them in a moment. But I can tell you, from looking back from the desk, looking back at the clerk's office as an attorney, I can tell you that there are desks that are empty that were full several years ago. They're making do with much fewer people. It used to be where for every judicial position, there were a significant number of people employed in other facets in the court behind each one that you see as a judge or commissioner. And that number has been cut by about two-thirds. And I mention that because as attorneys come into the court, they know where some of the holes are because you have to. But as somebody coming in who's not self-represented, you may be hitting an area where somebody doesn't see the papers that you would flag. You don't know the clerk to the judge and how to get them in. And I think it's largely a factor of your being self-represented and maybe not knowing how to fix some of the problems that the court has vis-a-vis your case. But I would like to turn it over to those that are more actively involved in that arena.
Well, I'll re-mention something I just said, and that is that idea of limited scope. If you could have an attorney just at the hearing with you, then that attorney would likely also take on the responsibility of drafting the findings in order after hearing, if appropriate. And that might be a way to get around the issue that you're talking about with these competing orders being presented to the court. And I also think that it varies from department to department, and I'm talking about a judicial department. I see a lot of judicial officers that are actually very sensitive to the needs of pro per litigants. The judicial officers actually go through training with regard to how to make sure that their courtroom is an open and accepting place for pro per litigants. I know I'm saying that, and I hear that your experience has not been that, but I can tell you that there is that movement within the Judicial Council and the Administrative Office of the Courts.
I would agree. And as someone who frequently assists individuals who are low income, their partners are low income and often unrepresented, I would also encourage you to try collaborating with your ex-wife's attorney to see if you can reach agreements as to what the findings and order after hearing should say, and then be able to alert the court when there is a disagreement about what the findings and order after hearing should include. That information can be presented to the court at the outset so that they know that there's a different order coming and the court's going to have to decide which one they want to sign off on.
Carlos, one thing that doesn't seem as obvious is when you're an attorney bringing something into court, you know more about what the law looks for going in, so you know how to write something that hits the very issues that the judge is looking for. And when you come in from outside without that knowledge, without that experience, it makes it that much harder. So even the best-intentioned judge is seeing one paper that perhaps answers his or her questions directly and another that may be very close but just doesn't look as direct to the question that's being asked. And of course, they haven't asked you the question. You're not there to hear the question because you're not in the room. So if you can have some assistance from someone with legal training, whether it's an attorney that, even if they don't come to court with you, helps you write the papers, even a paralegal, I would think that would help. What do you think? To my guess, do you think that this would help Carlos if he at least had somebody help him write the papers?
I think it's always helpful to have somebody in the legal field assist you with your paperwork. I think paralegals do a fantastic job when it comes to preparing orders from a court hearing. I would defer to an attorney, but certainly getting any kind of expert help that you could is going to be helpful.
Carlos, thank you. I hope we've been of some help to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Good luck, Carlos. And you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're talking about domestic violence and prevention of domestic violence. Our number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Howard from San Jose, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there, everybody. I have somebody living with me who is a victim of domestic violence. This person's parents, you know, the classic thing, super controlling, would force feed when they didn't want to eat or take away food when they wanted to eat. And when they didn't listen to the rules, they would get the 1-2 from the parents, where one would beat him up and then the other would blame them for getting hit by the other parent. Anyways, so this person is living with me. However, I'm trying to find out a way to get this person's personal documents from their parents while trying to minimize as much contact as possible with them. And I guess I'm also wondering, is there any way to make sure these people never get close to this person ever again?
So I'll address part of that. I guess the first question in my mind is, I'm assuming this person is an adult and not a minor?
Yes, an adult.
Okay. So this person could file for a domestic violence restraining order against his or her parents. Given that there is that relationship, that's the parent-child relationship, and if, you know, what you're saying qualifies as abuse under the code, and what happens is you start with putting forth a declaration before the court and applying for this, what we call a temporary restraining order. And the court is going to make the court is going to make a decision as to whether or not to issue this temporary restraining order, but then there'll be a hearing set. And at the hearing, the court is going to go through and sift through the facts more in detail to determine if the abuse really rises to the level of abuse under the code, including an attenuation of time. So you've told us a story about this adult who had controlling parents. If this was 10 years ago that this person experienced this with his or her parents and has had no contact since, that might not rise to the level of a restraining order because it's for someone who needs protection now. But there can be other circumstances that would rise to the level of this person needing a restraining order. Part of the restraining order process can be access to records. There is also, once you start a court case, what we call discovery. And in discovery, you can ask for documents to be produced. It is unfortunate that this is, you're looking at a lengthy lawsuit here to get to the point of discovery, but that is one way that this person could get their documents.
I think it's also important to mention that the primary purpose of a domestic violence restraining order is the order of protection. The court ordering that the person causing harm has to stay away from the individual who's the object of the harm and that they cannot contact this individual. However, there are many other things that can be accomplished through a domestic violence restraining order. The DVPA allows for the court to issue move-out orders when there has been physical abuse. The court can make support orders, both child and spousal support. There can be custody and visitation orders set up, property restraints for married individuals, and this catch-all section called other orders. And we often use this section of the domestic violence restraining order to specifically ask for return of property, such as vital documents. So that's another way that this person might be able to get their property back.
And I just want to also add something outside the legal context, because when you deal with these types of cases, you cannot only look through a legal lens. And that is, you know, what you're describing is someone who very much needs some counseling and therapy. So along with this, I don't think I ever meet with a client without telling them, here's what's going on in your legal case, and oh, get therapy. Because you cannot have gone through an abusive relationship and not need some type of support.
Howard, I hope we've been of some help to you.
And thank you very much, guys. You have been.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Good night.
Good night.
We've talked about definitions of domestic violence for purposes of family law, and we've talked about a social definition. There's additional definitions, are there not?
Yes.
Is there a tort? And by tort, that would be something one person sues another for those that are listening. Is there a tort definition for domestic violence?
Yes, there is. And the definition pretty much remains the same as the definition of domestic violence that I was talking about under the DVPA. However, the difference is anything under the DVPA is requesting that protection. The tort is actually suing somebody for the harm that they did to you. So you slip and fall in a grocery store, you can sue the grocery store for your damages. If somebody harms you in an intimate relationship, you can sue them for the harm that they've done to you.
Would the definition be pretty much the same?
The definition is very much the same.
Now, we're getting close to the half-hour mark, and before we take our break, I'd like to think about one thing, and we'll address it when we come back. As a practitioner of criminal law, the law treats domestic violence differently. If I do something to someone with whom I'm in a relationship, the law treats it with a much firmer hand than if I did something to someone I'm not within a relationship. I think there is ample reason for that, but I would like to be in a position when we come back from the break that we could address that, perhaps some of the policy reasons behind, and maybe that'll give people a lens as to what we're dealing with today. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KLWFM 91.7 in San Francisco. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Your Legal Rights will be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bay Association Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we were talking about why the law treats domestic violence differently than if the same act were committed between peoples that are not within a relationship. Would either of you like to address that a bit?
Sure. I'll start on that one. Going back to the example that you were using, Jeff, that if you and I are not in an intimate relationship, nor have we ever been in one, but I do know you. But if I hit you, that's going to be treated differently than if I hit, let's say, my husband. And the reasons for that are I have that relationship, that intimacy. And from a social policy perspective, we have to really look at what happens in intimate relationships that might keep that interaction, that abuse, from actually becoming public. It is very easy and acceptable for someone to come forward and say, hey, someone I don't know assaulted me, go arrest that person. It is a very different dynamic to say someone I know and love and may have children with assaulted me. And we treat the domestic violence different than other violence, and I'll just say intimate partner violence, which is another phrase that is sometimes more commonly used within the domestic violence world or the intimate partner violence world, because we have these social norms that it's an embarrassment to come forward and say I've been abused by someone I love. There's a shame that goes with it. And what we want to do is let people know there, A, is no shame in this, but B, and perhaps more importantly, that that's not an appropriate intimate relationship. That's not what happens in healthy relationships. And so we need to be able to give an avenue within the law that someone can come forward and say, I need these protections. And you talked before about the differences, especially when we talk about criminal and the family law aspect of domestic violence. And as Melissa was mentioning, there are so many more forms of relief that come with a restraining order under the Domestic Violence Protection Act because you're dealing with a family. Custody, visitation orders, the support orders, everything around your family. We see the legislature constantly expanding the relief that you can get under a domestic violence or a DVPA order because it is looking at your family from a holistic perspective and giving that healing to all parts of that relationship.
And of course, two obvious things that come to mind in the example you gave is if you and I are in a relationship and you hit me, where am I going to go? And given that we're not in a relationship, I know I can go home and be safe, and you're not going to show up at my door.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's why supportive services are so important. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the forms of relief that is available through a domestic violence restraining order is that move-out order, so that the individual who is experiencing the harm can remain in the home, potentially with the children that they share with the abusive partner, to ensure their safety. And if that home is not safe, there are services out there, such as the agency that I work for, that can provide shelter on a temporary basis to those who are experiencing abuse.
And I think I also want to add that what we're looking at in domestic violence as opposed to violence between strangers or people that know each other from a handshake perspective is there's another dynamic that happens here. There is what we've been talking about, this power and control, this coercive control that happens, and it is very unique because of that intimate relationship. And that's another reason why we treat the violence between intimate partners different.
Ultimately, what you're saying, just to flesh it out a little, is that the batterer prevents the other party from living their life in a normal fashion.
Yes, that's correct. And there's what we call the cycle of violence that we see happen. I think that, you know, one of the things I see over and over again, and I'm sure Melissa has the same experience in my cases, is I'll be working with a client and I will explain to them what their life has been like. And they will look at me with these saucer eyes and say, well, that's exactly what happens. How did you know that? And because there really is this almost predictable dynamic of power and control that happens in these types of relationships. And part of that power and control, and what we so often see, is the batterer slowly is pulling their victim from all other connections, their family connections, their community connections, and there's an isolation that happens. And when you're living in that isolation, and the person that you chose to be your life partner is telling you, you deserve this, and you're not deserving of anything good, you start to internalize that.
And before we go to the next step, I'd like to talk about is the process and what people want to do if you find yourself in that situation, or perhaps somebody close to you is in that situation and you come to that realization. But one thing that we haven't discussed is domestic violence and how it affects children. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about that for a little bit first?
Sure. So there has been a lot of research recently that shows that children who are in a home where domestic violence is occurring are at an increased risk of either being perpetrators themselves when they get older or being victims. And all too often, my clients will say, well, my child was in the home, but they were sleeping. They didn't know what was going on. And there's a lot of social science research that would suggest that that's not true. In fact, that children as young as 3-4 years old know when there is tension between their parents and understand that yelling and hitting are not good feelings. And California law in particular has really internalized this social science research and has developed code sections to say that domestic violence hurts children. And a lot of our laws in the family law system are geared towards ensuring that children who are exposed to domestic violence, or if they are in fact victims themselves, are going to be treated differently than children who do not experience that dynamic in their home.
I don't presently practice in the area of juvenile dependency, but I did for a short time. One of the things I've noticed about dependency law is that it seems to seriously recognize what you're saying just now about its effect on the children, and even the abused party can face a dependency case for not protecting their children from observing domestic violence when they're in fact not the perpetrator of that violence, but perhaps they should have taken their children first, placed their well-being as being more important than some of the others, and taken the children away. Do either of you have experience with children in that situation and parents that are having some splaining to do because they didn't protect their kids?
I do have experience with that, and I think we have a judicial system that does the best it can to protect children. And what I think happens sometimes is the dynamics that are going on within a family that's experiencing domestic violence, they're very unique. And the victim of domestic violence that is in a position where he or she is the recipient of abuse with the child in the home that's witnessing this may not have a place to go. Oftentimes, and I'll be stereotypic and also state that statistically, I'm going to get myself probably in a lot of trouble for saying this, but it is more often the male that is the abuser. This is not by any means meaning to say that women can't be abusers as well, but to talk about this particular situation if you have a man who is supporting the family and abusing the family. And then you have the mother who really doesn't necessarily have a place to go because that's her financial support. Where is she supposed to go with her children to support them? And then you have Child Protective Services coming in and saying, well, you allowed this to happen to your child, so we could take your child for that. It's a dicey situation that we often have to deal with. And I think that for the most part, what I've seen is a greater sensitivity to these types of situations where children aren't necessarily being taken, but the situation is being recognized for what it is, and supportive services are being given to that family as opposed to taking children away and giving the abused party a sense of support and empowerment so that he or she can take control of their lives and be the protective parent that they want to be.
I'd also add that in the dependency system, much like the criminal system, individuals going through that process have a right to counsel. So it's not like the family law system where 80% of litigants are pro per or representing themselves. In the dependency system, all parties in that lawsuit have access to counsel and will be represented by counsel.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We're talking about the prevention of domestic violence or relationship abuse. I'd like to reiterate, anyone having an interest in issues surrounding relationship abuse, for that matter, I'll open it up to people who have family law issues that may be closely related or even perhaps not. Anybody who has an interest in issues surrounding relationship abuse, whether it's between married people or parent and child, to please feel free to call in. Our number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside our local dialing area, that's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We were talking about some of the policy reasons. We've had a few people's specific experience. I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk a bit about the nuts and bolts. If you find somebody close to you and learn that he or she has been a victim of domestic violence, what can you do to help? How can you steer that person into a better situation?
So first and foremost, listen, and listen without judgment. It's taking the individual experiencing domestic violence a lot of courage to be able to share that with you. If this is a friend or a family member, or even if it's somebody who you don't have a close relationship, such as a coworker, it's important to make sure that this individual knows that you are there to support them and that you're not going to try to push them in one direction or another. It's very common for individuals when they find that they're friends or family members are experiencing domestic violence that they want to try and fix the situation and force this individual to leave the relationship. And the person experiencing the domestic violence might not be ready for that. They may never be in a position where they want to end the relationship. And as Lauren was mentioning, there's many different reasons why somebody chooses to stay in a domestic violence relationship. So the best thing that you can do is listen and connect that person to resources. Find the local domestic violence agency that serves your county. And if you don't know what that agency is, there is a national domestic violence hotline that you can call. The telephone number is 1-800-799-7233. And they will be able to link you up to the local resources. And additionally, I think it's really important to make sure that the person, if they do choose to enter the legal system for support, whether it be filing for a domestic violence restraining order or a divorce or a petition for custody, that they are getting accurate legal information. One of the dynamics of domestic violence relationship is that the person perpetrating the harm provides incorrect information, and baseless threats to the victim of domestic violence. So making sure that that person has accurate legal information to dispel some of those inaccurate statements of the perpetrator, and so that they can get into the legal system and get the support that they need.
And I would also add that if you are in fact the person that is experiencing abuse and you are in a dangerous situation, by all means call 911. And when the police come out, they will likely offer, but if they don't, you can ask for what is called an emergency protective order, which is kind of like a mini restraining order. They're issued on the spot by law enforcement and can act as protection. They really are a restraining order for 5 days, which can involve also that residence exclusion order, that kick-out order that Melissa was referencing before, so that the victim then can seek appropriate legal services to apply for a temporary restraining order and go through the restraining order process that we've been talking about.
And just to clarify, when you say a mini restraining order, it's only mini in the sense that it only lasts for 5 days. But in fact, it's a full and complete stay away order if it's been so ordered.
That's correct. That the only mini is the time.
So somebody sees that they need help. They call 911. Maybe they get the emergency protective order. What can they expect from the system? What comes next?
Well, if they want the protection of the emergency protective order to go beyond the 5 days, then they would need to apply for their own domestic violence restraining order in the family law system under the Domestic Violence Prevention Act. And that starts with an application. And the individual can indicate what orders they're requesting, the no contact, stay away, move out orders, child custody and visitation orders, etc. That they write their declaration about the abuse that they've been experiencing and why they're asking the court for the protection. That gets submitted to the judge, and the judge, within one business day, will review it. And if the judge feels that the individual needs immediate protection, they'll issue a temporary restraining order. And that temporary order remains in effect for approximately 3 weeks and expires on the day of the court hearing that the judge assigns to the case.
Now, getting paperwork in front of the judge sounds like a pretty scary prospect. When somebody goes to court, is there somebody there to help them?
It depends on the county. Some counties do have assistants in the courtroom that will help prepare the paperwork and make sure that anybody who is a victim of domestic violence is walking out of that courtroom with their orders in hand, as well as the restrained party coming out of the courtroom with their orders in hand. Some counties have programs where you can get representation. And again, that limited scope so that a victim can be represented at a hearing. One of the things, going back to what we were saying, what you were asking before about what can a victim expect, I always tell people courts are not proactive. Courts are reactive. Oftentimes, I deal with victims who are saying, well, I got my emergency protective order and then the court didn't do anything. That is not the role of the court. The court reacts to motions that are put before the court, and this application that we're talking about is actually a motion that goes before the court saying, I want these orders. So if you want orders from the court, you always have to apply to the court.
So the bottom line is, you're not going to get anything unless you ask for it.
Correct.
So if you're in need, you need to ask for it.
Absolutely.
Yes.
In addition to the courts, some courts have more staffing than others. What other places can somebody go?
So that depends on the resources that are available in each county. As I mentioned earlier, each county does have a self-help center or family law facilitator's office, and that is one place that a person experiencing domestic violence can go for assistance in completing their request for a domestic violence restraining order. Other counties with a little bit more resources might have agencies that operate restraining order clinics. And in the Bay Area, the main agency that operates restraining order clinics clinics is Bay Area Legal Aid. In San Mateo County, they have a clinic every day of the week at some location in the county. I know that you can go to their website and look at each county and find out what days and locations they have various legal clinics. So a domestic violence restraining order clinic is a great place for somebody to start. Often those agencies have relationships with the court to ensure that the petitions for domestic violence restraining orders are reviewed each day so that the person who has applied for the order has a decision on their temporary restraining order the same day that they file that request.
And I want to go back to this, your question for what does someone do to reach out for assistance. One of the things we want to be very careful of when we're dealing with victims of domestic violence is what we call safety planning. Reaching out for help can be dangerous. For example, searching on a computer, I want to research the effects of domestic violence. Well, you leave behind a history of the sites that you visited. So we recommend that people go to a library or use a public computer where someone is not going to be able to look at your computer, your abuser, for example, and see that you have been looking at this. Most domestic violence agencies, I can tell you my firm's website, we have a safe exit so that it doesn't leave a trail. Same thing with using your phone. If your abuser has access to your phone, your passwords, your accounts, those are not safe places to seek help.
I'm Jeff Hayden, and you are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco or KALW.org. We're talking about the prevention of domestic violence and protecting those that have been victims of domestic violence or relationship abuse. If you wish to call us here in the studio one last time, our number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I would be remiss if I didn't repeat for those who need it the number that Melissa gave out a few minutes ago for the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 800-799-7233. You may not need it now, but if there's any question at all, this is a number that you may want to put away somewhere. And that, again, is the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 800-799-7233. We did have a caller recently who asked so that they could have it available also for the contact information so that you could reach my guests when the show is over. You can reach Lauren Zorfis at adzlaw.com. Melissa Gibbs at Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse, also known as CORA. You can find their information at corasupport.org. We have another caller on the line who's on their way in, but in the meantime, we spoke earlier, before the show began to air, about a safety plan. Can you tell us a little bit about what you had in mind with a safety plan?
Yeah, as Lauren mentioned earlier, seeking support can actually be a very lethal point in somebody's domestic violence relationship. In fact, the research suggests that when somebody chooses to leave, their risk actually goes up significantly. So it's really important that you speak with a crisis counselor to do some safety planning. If you choose to stay in an abusive relationship, it's really important to do safety planning. You want to have a plan in place for both you and any children that you may have in the home, so that if there is a domestic violence incident, you know exactly how you're going to react. Is it that you go to a friend or family member's residence? Is there somebody that you can call and have that telephone number on speed dial? going over this information with your children so that they know how to exit the home? Is there a location in your home that is safer than other locations? We always recommend not to go to kitchens during a domestic violence incident because there are many instruments in a kitchen typically that can be used to perpetrate abuse. You want to make sure that you have some of your vital records, a little bit of money, important telephone numbers, medications, in a location that you can easily access should you need to leave in a hurry. Additionally, having a domestic violence hotline available, as you just gave out the number again, Jeff, thank you, so that you know who you can call for support should you need it.
Friends, most of our listeners, that's most of you listening right now, live in earthquake country. We've all been raised with the idea that you need to have a plan so that if the worst happens, you have a place for the family to meet. If your house might not be standing because of an earthquake, or you can't get back to it, the phones may not be working for a while, how are your family going to meet up? How are you going to get by the next few days? And it seems to me that what you've just been saying, Melissa, is some very good common sense strategy for having a means to get through a brief period of time. If the worst happens, how are you going to get through the next couple of days while you are seeking help?
That's correct, Jeff.
Before we end tonight, I would like to give each of you a chance to sum up or add anything that you wish to come across in the next couple minutes before we go. I think that's a very poignant note to raise that you just did, but I'd like to give each of you a chance to add to that.
I will just say that if you yourself or anyone you know is experiencing abuse in a relationship, if it is you yourself, reach out to somebody. Know that you are not alone. Know that this affects a large number of people in our community. Know that there is support waiting for you. There is a happier life waiting for you. If it is someone that you know or love that is experiencing this, I cannot emphasize enough what Melissa said about listening without judgment. Because statistically, I know Melissa's going to know this, I'm blanking on it, how many times it takes for an abuse victim to try and leave their abuser. It's not the first time, it's not the second time, and it's not the third or fourth time that someone will actually leave their abuser. It takes several attempts for someone to finally make that change. And knowing that they have someone listening without judgment is huge.
Yes, and the number is 7. It takes an average of 7 attempts to leave before an individual is actually able to separate from their abusive partner. I want to echo what Lauren just said. This is not an issue that affects one type of person. Domestic violence is present in all types of relationships. It impacts everyone, regardless of socioeconomic status, your race, your gender identity, your sexual orientation. This is a community issue, and it impacts all of us. The statistic is 1 in 3 women and 1 in 5 men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And there is support out there. And I encourage anyone who knows somebody or who is experiencing domestic violence themselves to reach out for support.
And for that support, one more time, the National Domestic Violence Hotline can be reached at 800-799-7233. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight has been preventing domestic violence, sometimes called relationship abuse, including the use of the Domestic Violence Prevention Act. My guests tonight have been the former family law facilitator for the San Mateo County Superior Court, Lauren Zorfis, practicing family law attorney. She can be reached at adzlaw.com. And Melissa Gibbs, the manager of legal services at CORA, Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse in San Mateo. at corasupport.org. Thank you both for joining us. We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where we will be discussing relations between the police, the community, and issues of race. My guest will be John Burris. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. Our thanks to you listeners for listening, to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls for the vacationing, Joanne Marr, my friend Debbie Kennedy. I'm Jeff Hayden, and thank you for joining us.